I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. Italy is the eye of the coronavirus storm, the epicenter of the chaos in treatment and of the world's heartbreak and dread. Italy's death toll in the global pandemic passed 3,400 this week, exceeding the losses in China. At the same time, in the crazy quilt of plague sites all over the world, even in Italy, there are broad patches apparently untouched by the virus. And in the jumble of mismatching statistics, there was plenty of reason this week to question and doubt the worst-case scenario that the rest of Europe and even North America could be 10 days away from Italy's nightmare. The voice of Europe on American Public Radio, Silvia Poggioli, gave us a sense of the scene this week in her neighborhood by the Tiber in the heart of Rome.
I went out only one evening, and it was a rather disturbing after I went for work reasons, and poorly lit street, nobody on the street. All I could hear was sirens in the distance or see police cars with flashing blue lights. It felt very creepy, very, very ominous. I felt like almost I was in the Rome of Caravaggio. It was very badly lit street, very dark shadows. Yeah, the atmosphere is very, very disturbing.
And the numbers, 3,000 people just about have died in Italy, and everybody feels there's this wave. We're 10 days away from being Italy. But I wonder, what have we learned? What have Italians learned about what went wrong in this very strange checkerboard pattern? But also, what to this point, Silvia, is working?
Italy has turned out to be, at least in the West, outside of China, the kind of the laboratory of this thing. I think it's now every single country is repeating the same kind of things that happened here. It happened so suddenly. Nobody knew what it was. And you looked around and all of a sudden it was an epidemic before anybody understood what the disease was. In the case of Italy, of why the numbers of the death toll, the mortality rate appears to be very high, even higher than in China. And one of the reasons apparently is that Italy has a very old population. It's the second oldest in the world after Japan. And the average age of the people who died is 80. And it is said that practically absolutely everybody who died had some other disease, hypertension, diabetes, something else. And so that perhaps is one reason why in Italy the mortality rate seems to be higher even than it was in China. And we don't know why the epicenter was in northern Italy, in Lombardy. There are now some, not stories, but some appear to be some reports that perhaps patient zero was actually a German who had contacted the disease from a Chinese business partner and then traveled to northern Italy. And that's perhaps how the epidemic in Europe started there. In terms of what people have learned, I think people can look to Italy, the experience almost like, you know, the laboratory where everybody else will follow pretty soon. I think the lesson, first of all, is be able to prepare very quickly, very suddenly, hospitals into COVID-19 hospitals. Be able to have well-trained staff, retrain your doctors and nurses to be able to deal with the respiratory problems of which will be involved with this virus. Nobody's prepared. It turns out, in a way, it's a fortune that this thing happened in northern Italy, where the health system is much, much better than southern Italy. That has been very important. If it had happened in the south, who knows what the numbers would be.
It's that spike, Silvia, the exponential growth that scares the wits out of people. What do we know about that, the curve that spikes upward? Do we have an explanation?
Well, the problem is that it's people are circulating too much. People have to lock down. This is the today we are now into, I believe it's day 8 or 9 of the lockdown in the nationwide part of the lockdown in Italy, and the numbers are still going up. The experts say don't expect the numbers to go down until probably the end of next week, because the people who are now the positive cases every day are people who contracted the contagion before the lockdown. It's an incubation period period of something like 5 to 10 days. Italians have reacted in an extraordinary way, very much accepting the idea of the lockdown. Today, there was a poll that said in La Repubblica that said 94% of Italians approve the measures. From what you see, it looks like everybody's, you know, really observing. But the authorities are complaining, especially in the north, in Milan, that too many people are still circulating. They're talking about turning the screw even more. I don't know what that means. If they start shutting down food shops, grocery stores, that, I don't know, you know, that'll be a real problem, because right now the only stores that can stay open are food, grocery stores, pharmacies, and newsstands. So if they crack down even more, I don't know. But as it is now, the country is basically virtually, the entire population is under some kind of house arrest.
Part of the news this week came from a critical shaking of the numbers in this plague and a lesson in how not to read them. On the Stat News website, a forum of health and science professionals, a respected contrarian at the Stanford Medical School, Dr. John Ioannidis, wrote that there could be a fiasco in the making in the, his words, utterly unreliable evidence on the coronavirus. So we called him up in Palo Alto, and he answered.
We have information that is clearly highly biased because of the nature of how it is being collected. The number of people documented with infection by SARS-CoV-2 is clearly far less compared to the much larger pool of people who are infected in the community. But we don't have testing done systematically to be able to tell how many people are infected in the community. This means that some of the very basic features, like what is the likelihood that someone will die if one is infected? Or what is the expected proportion of the population that may be infected during the course of the pandemic? We have very little evidence that we can trust. And this is really scary because we're making decisions that are shaping the future of our entire world.
You say the data is utterly unreliable, and you make an instance of the Diamond Princess cruise ship on which the 1% fatality number was based. Take us through that.
The Diamond Princess cruise ship is a very nice opportunity to study a closed population. We have information on practically everybody who was on board, passengers and crew. We have tested everyone, and we know how many people were infected, and also we know what happened to those people who were infected, how many people died. We know that the proportion of people who died was 1% of those who were infected. We also know very well the distribution of the ages and also how many men and women were on board. And therefore, we can infer what would these death rates translate to if we tried to create an analogy to a general population, like the U.S. population. So 1% is what is observed in that cohort of mostly elderly passengers. The average age was 58 and the median age was close to 65 probably, versus the entire population of the U.S., which is much younger. And if we try to extrapolate, that 1% observed case fatality ratio probably becomes much, much lower. There's, of course, a lot of uncertainty because we only have 7 deaths that have happened, at least so far, among the passengers in that ship. So this means that we need to be very cautious about what the uncertainty is. We need to take into account also that maybe a couple of people may die later, and also the fact that maybe people who take a cruise will have different health compared to those who do not in terms of chronic diseases. You know, some people may be on a cruise because they're perfectly healthy, and some others may be on a cruise because this is their last trip that they know that they're dying in 2 months and they just want to have some nice time in the last couple months of their life. But taking these components of uncertainty into account, it's very likely that the infection fatality rate is much, much lower than what has been circulated. It may not be very different from that of seasonal flu. There is a chance that it may even be lower. There's, of course, a very good chance that it may be larger. But if it's larger, it's not terribly larger as we had thought originally.
There are two percentages in circulation that scare people out of their wits. 60% of the world could be infected. That's an educated guess. Turns out to be 4 billion people. At a 1% kill rate, we could have 40 million people dead. on a scale of the epic flu of 1918, World War I. Are we talking those numbers, or is that crazy?
So this is the most pessimistic scenario, and as we just discussed, the 1% is probably unrealistic. It must be much, much lower. The 60% is based on some mathematical modeling, and this has a lot of assumptions that one needs to take into account. One is trying to estimate what is the basic reproductive number on how the epidemic is spreading, but the estimates of the basic reproductive number that are already in the literature vary from 1.3 to 6.5. So there's tremendous heterogeneity, and the data that we have are pretty much limited to be able to have conclusive statements about extrapolating to the entire global population. So I think 60% is the most pessimistic scenario of the most pessimistic calculations, in a sense. So it's an extreme of an extreme. But we really don't know, because we don't have reliable data. Now, if you run these calculations with 60% and 1% case fatality rate, indeed you calculate 40 million people dead, which is exactly the same number as what happened in 1918. But if you look more closely, the analogy completely breaks down immediately, because in 1918, the average age of people dying was 28 years old. They were very young people with all their life in front of them. So the loss of lives and quality years was tremendous. In the case of COVID-19, the average age is probably about 70, 75 or higher in different countries, and almost everybody is either very, very old or has a number of underlying conditions, you know, serious diseases. So if you also take into account that the population of the world has grown about five times since 1918, that 10% of impact becomes 2% if you correct for the size of the population in relative terms. Mm. If you further correct for the fact that these estimates of 60% and 1% are probably extremes and unrealistic, that 1% may become even 0.1%. So we are talking about a pandemic that is likely to be 100 times less or 1,000 times less in terms of impact compared to the 1918 influenza pandemic, as far as the infection component of impact is concerned.
Dr. Ioannidis's piece at statnews.com reads like the best of Sherlock Holmes. Coming up, the tricky business of ranking coronavirus among all-time disasters like the flu of 1918 and HIV/AIDS in the 1980s. This is Open Source. David Jones is the sometime pediatrician and professor turned historian of medicine at Harvard. He was the one who tipped me to Dr. Ioannidis's piece on Stat News, and then he expanded on his own problems setting coronavirus numbers so far in the long view of epidemics.
One thing for me as a historian to suggest that maybe we're overreacting, but he's one of the most respected proponents of evidence-based medicine. And he really lays into this with very strong rhetoric. And it'll be very interesting to see what kind of reaction that generates, because so many people are completely committed to the party line that this is an apocalypse and we need to do everything and upend the universe to prepare. And the challenge is they may be right. And so the precautionary principle might say we should be doing everything that we should be doing. And so there are people who are arguing that this might be awful, and so we should do everything in our power to prevent it. And that may be wise. But there's a growing chorus of people coming from very different places on the political spectrum that are unhappy about this. I mean, there has been a constant current, especially from conservatives to the right of Trump, whether they're saying this is a hoax or something else.
The Sean Hannity line, yeah.
Now there are a lot of people who are really enraged about government overreach. You know, the government is shutting down businesses, and shutting down businesses basically seizing private property. And now Trump is using the Defense Powers Act, whatever it's called, to dictate what companies can produce. And, you know, how can the government do this? And of course, you know, these Republicans have only a Republican administration to blame. I can't imagine what their rhetoric would have been like had Obama attempted anything like this.
But if the rhetoric is out of line, David, how explain the deaths in Italy, for example?
Yeah, it's just interesting to see that the pushback against the catastrophe rhetoric is coming both from extreme conservatives and then very reasoned scholars like the guy at Stanford. And so you have very different sorts of people making a similar kind of argument.
Hmm.
And whether or not it's appropriate, it's hard to say. Like, we've now lost a third of the value of the stock market. Thousands of people are now unemployed, and I assume that will be millions soon. Whole sectors of the economy have been totally ravaged. In Massachusetts, there are still zero deaths, relatively few admissions, and a number of new cases each day that's been cooking along steadily at 15 to 20 last time I checked, new cases a day. And so if you were going to look at, you know, stock market damage per death, that number is off the charts.
Wow.
Compared to anything we've ever experienced.
And I'm told there are towns, even little regions in Italy, not far from Lombardy, that are untouched.
Yeah, I haven't taken a deep dive into the Italian stuff. Most of the stories I hear from my colleagues start off, and I have a friend who is a physician in X, and I've heard this now, people talking about Germany, and someone I was talking to today who has friends who are physicians in Bergamo, which is the place that has been hit hardest in Italy.
Right.
And the stories are, you know, stories of the apocalypse of physicians who have three patients who need ventilators and there's only one ventilator. You know, these are all the classic scenarios that medical ethicists love to teach their students. How do you choose whose life to save?
Right.
And you certainly see photographs of stretchers in hallways of hospitals. But then I also heard an interview with some guy who runs one of the hospitals. They haven't actually yet had to take someone off life support.
Even in Italy, surely, I mean, we're told that these choices are being made.
I haven't dug in deeply enough to know what's really true. What are rumors about Italy versus what's actually happening in Italy? But the one thing that is clear, which is what you had said, if you go from city to city across North Italy, and especially if you look between North and South Italy, there are wildly different stories. Milan and Bergamo have been hit hard. Other places haven't been touched. And it was a similar situation in China. Wuhan was hit very hard.
Right.
Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou.
Hong Kong, barely at all.
Not so much. Hong Kong, Singapore. You know, Singapore had massive exposure. I saw a video of downtown Singapore the other day. Maybe it's slightly less crowded, but, you know, people are out on the streets. Life is going on as usual. And they have a very sophisticated system. They're testing widely. When they get a positive hit, they then implement intensive measures around that focal hit.
Mm.
It seems to be working. And that's what Hong Kong did. Whereas in the U.S., we have not yet had a functional testing system. And so in the absence of that, they're shutting down the country. It's totally astonishing.
You make me question everything. But viral outbreaks are real. We remember the AIDS siege very vividly. We know the Spanish flu in 1918. I mean, how can it possibly be an uncertainty that the deaths are real?
The ability for a virus to wreak havoc in the human population is undeniable. Those are the two best examples. You know, HIV has killed 40 million people. 1918 flu was 50 to 100 million people. If you want to give yourself nightmares, read accounts of the smallpox epidemics, especially among American Indian populations or in the POW camps during the Civil War or in Fiji, or read an account of anyone who dies of rabies. I mean, viruses can cause total horror, no doubt about that. But there are a lot of viruses out there, and most of them aren't causing total horror. At any given time, most of us are carriers of a bunch of different viruses. Loads of people have oral or genital herpes. Loads of people have human papillomavirus. Anyone who has got chickenpox before the vaccine has varicella virus hiding out somewhere deep in our brain, waiting to come out and cause shingles as we get older. So there are many, many viruses that are out and about. You know, the average American gets a couple colds a year. People get gastrointestinal viruses periodically. They're there, they're prevalent, they're out and about.
Is this the story that we all ought to be pursuing? Why we haven't had an argument around the shutdown, the lockdown? It has become the virtuous, good, decent human citizen thing to do, to stay at home, maybe indefinitely, maybe till August. And, you know, people like Mayor de Blasio of New York seemed to resist the school shutdown, but finally did it. It's taken now to be the only way. Should this be argued?
Yes. The problem is the uncertainty. What we don't know is COVID more like 1918 flu or 2009 flu? Is it more like SARS or is it more like any of the million other respiratory viruses that get us each year? We don't know. And in the absence of that knowledge, since it could be a disaster and we have no way of proving that it's not going to be a disaster, we are now being told that the only thing for virtuous citizens to do is to go home.
Stay home.
And there are people who will say, even if we don't have any idea how likely a disaster is, we should do everything in our power to prevent it. That is a defensible position. I think it would be great to have that discussion of, is this what we should be doing? But it's not going to be a satisfying discussion because in the end, the answer is going to be, we just don't know. And so how cautious do we want to be in the face of that uncertainty? I mean, certainly if we do nothing and it's a fiasco, it'll be a tragedy that we'll regret until the end of our lives.
You're the historian. What is the worst instance of a government overreacting or interventions that cost lives in the end?
The current moment, the jury is still out. You know, the stock market losing a third of its value mostly hurts the top few percent. So that's not necessarily a human tragedy. The loads of people in the service sector who are now unemployed, that's going to cost lives. People die from poverty. We're now impoverishing lots of people or adding massive financial stress to people who are worried about whether or not they're going to make rent. There are plenty of people who would otherwise have been going to ERs yesterday and today and tomorrow who aren't going because they're frightened and being told to stay away. And some of them are going to die of heart attacks that didn't get the treatment that they needed. The flip side, there was an estimate by a different research group out at Stanford. My Harvard handlers will regret that I keep talking about Stanford research, but suggesting that the shutdown of Chinese industry has now saved 50 to 75,000 people in China alone because of reduced air pollution.
Wow.
The claim is that 50 to 75,000 lives have now been saved because of reduced air pollution.
By the shutdown of industry.
Yeah. Anyway, NASA obliges by producing before and after photographs, and the dissipation of air pollution is dramatic, both in China and North Italy. I was trying to do the seat of the pants calculation to see if that, you know, sort of passed the sniff test as a plausible number. And so the number I happen to know is that in China each year there are 1.75 million deaths from artery disease. So 1.75 million deaths from heart disease, mostly heart attacks. That's a lot of deaths. You know, most of that's from cigarette smoking, but it'd be reasonable to say that air pollution is responsible for, you know, some chunk of those, say 10 or 20% of those. So then you're saying that air pollution each year, you know, kills 200,000 people in China from heart disease. And then there are probably a handful of others from respiratory disease, lung cancer, other things. So, you know, a couple hundred thousand people a year dying in China. Same thing in India. Numbers are smaller in the U.S. because the air is cleaner and the population is smaller. Well, if it's 200,000 deaths a year, divide that by six to figure out how many deaths that is every 2 months, you're in the order of 30 to 40,000 deaths every 2 months. So that number is, coming out of Stanford, is in a plausible order of magnitude. You could look in detail at the study and see exactly how they get it. They would have done it in a more sophisticated way than I'm doing it by the seat of my pants. But again, the order of magnitude is plausible. Now you're in the sunny situation. So here I am saying, I'm afraid we're overreacting. More people will die from the overreaction than from COVID. But at the same time, the overreaction by shutting down industry is going to save many more lives. So how do you do the accounting? And at that point, my head explodes.
And then apply it to Italy. Yep. What could account for those deaths, the belated lockdown, the loss of life?
With the caveat, I haven't done a deep dive into the Italian situation. There have been many, certainly many tragic COVID deaths in Italy. One thing I'd love to know, if you look at the top 10 causes of daily mortality in Italy at baseline, which is going to be heart attacks, lung cancer, and then the usual suspects for the top 10, has COVID broken into that top 10 yet?
Do you know?
I don't think so. I think Italy is reporting on the scale of hundreds of deaths a day from COVID. Somewhere out there is the number of how many people die every day in Italy, and then you can see how those COVID deaths stack up against the other leading causes of death. My suspicion, I don't know, but my suspicion is that COVID is still a relatively small player in the overall mortality of Italy. It certainly wasn't China. You know, as I said, you know, China has had 5,000 deaths from COVID in 2 months and has 5,000 deaths a day from heart attacks. So it's a 60-fold difference. Let's see, the U.S. has roughly 500,000 deaths a year from heart disease. So that's 1,000, 1,500 deaths a day from heart attacks. We're still at scores of, I mean, I don't think we're at 100 deaths a day from COVID. Massachusetts is still zero deaths from COVID. Mm. And so again, in terms of a total mortality count, it's still relatively low. I mean, it's much lower than flu, but it's dramatic. It is causing, in some Italian hospitals, it's causing these very dramatic scenes of overwhelmed hospitals, people dying who would likely have been saved had the hospital had more capacity to care for them. And that is very sad. Why Wuhan? Why North Italy? And why no place else? Is it because of the age structure? You know, people say, you know, Italy has a population that tends older. Well, so does Japan. And Japan has gotten off relatively easily from COVID.
Dave Jones, this is fundamentally challenging. I mean, we're talking about a pandemic, but also a panic with a sort of life of its own. How will we sort those out? Has there ever been a panic that was not justified by, you know, the mortality?
Yeah, happens all the time with influenza. In 1976, there was an influenza panic. Forecasts of a bad influenza pandemic. Ford mobilizes a mass immunization campaign. The epidemic didn't materialize. 2009, there was a big influenza pandemic, and it started off with a Mexico, you know, Mexicans blamed California, California blamed Mexico. It was an American pork producing plant in the city where the outbreak started, so people blamed those pigs for introducing to it. They, you know, they identified the first kid, child in Mexico, so it was identified patient zero. If you go back, I know there were, China put travel restrictions on the U.S. You know, I had colleagues going to China for conferences who ended up 3 weeks in home confinement in China while they were quarantined. There were all these photographs that circulated that summer, like, you know, kids at summer camps wearing face masks. Not nearly as dramatic as now, but at the time, a very dramatic response. The WHO officially did declare that a pandemic, and in 2009, flu mortality was lower than usual.
Wow.
You know, people have made fun of WHO for refusing to call this a pandemic until very late in the process. I assume part of the reason that WHO was so slow to call this a pandemic was because they got burned so badly when they overcalled the 2009 one.
Wow. But you're telling us something very fundamentally interesting, that this thing should be marked in doubt, in question, unproven so far, and that the panic may have run ahead of the pandemic.
And the frustrating thing is that we will likely never know. Now, obviously, if it, you know, hits the fan, we will all agree that there was an epidemic and it will be awful. If it doesn't, it will possibly be forever an open-ended question. Was it not going to happen, or was it going to happen and it was stopped because we were virtuous citizens and we followed the directives to stay inside until mid-May or beyond? Now, it could be that people will be able to do sort of the post-event autopsy in a way that has now been done for 1918, and look and find resolution, whether it's country by country or state by state or city by city. And if you're able to show that in places that were completely fastidious, like Singapore, there was nothing, in places like Italy that were slow to adopt measures, it was a disaster. And if you have enough of those cases side by side, you might be able to answer the question after the fact, would it have happened had we done nothing? And so we might get an answer in the end. But right now, there's so much uncertainty.
It sounds like the argument of the century, and it may take a century to work it out. This is incredible.
And the immediate cost is unprecedented.
Bye-bye airline industry, for example.
Or by stock market, or 401ks, or all the restaurant workers who are now getting laid off. You know, airlines are just like, you know, JetBlue announced it's going to cancel, is it going to reduce 240% or reduce, I mean, roughly canceling half its capacity.
What is the citizen to do about this, about the doubt? Stay tuned, maybe.
In the short term, even though I'm skeptical, I think the better part of valor is to continue to do what we've been asked to do. I would never have predicted that the U.S. population would be willing to do this to the extent that we have. And it sounds like not everyone is on board. You know, Bill de Blasio got mad that New York bars and restaurants were so crowded on Saturday. Same thing happened in Chicago. I was talking to one of my colleagues who spent the day out in parks in Natick. And apparently the parks were full of refugee college students who were hanging out and not social distancing. One of the other headlines for today is the shift in story about children. So the initial reports have been coming out is that children are strangely immune or resilient and just didn't seem to be getting sick, which would be fantastic if it's true. And now, in the setting of officials being cranky about non-compliant young adults, now there are all these reports coming out of young adults actually getting seriously ill. And that woman is Dr. Birx, who's on the COVID response team for the White House, said something completely incomprehensible at the noon press conference. What she was trying to say was that even though the risk of a bad outcome in a teenager is lower than the risk of a bad outcome in an older person, there are so many teenagers that there will be some number of them who have bad outcomes. You know, it's maybe a reasonable message. And then there was a report out of China this morning that in newborns and very young infants, COVID can also wreak havoc, which is completely unsurprising. Usually the people who are most vulnerable to viral respiratory epidemics are always the elderly, the oldest and the youngest. Newborns have very small airways and not a whole lot of reserve, and so it doesn't take much to get them into trouble. And so the weird thing had been these reports that kids didn't seem affected. Now that exceptionalism seems to be waning. If it turns out that in COVID, the very old and the very young are most vulnerable, that would almost be reassuring in some kind of perverse way, just because that's how all other respiratory viruses behave.
Coming up, Andrew Sullivan reflecting on his own 35 years in the shadows of virus world. This is Open Source. Andrew Sullivan has been known since his 20s for being many things at once, an Irish Englishman in America, a self-styled conservative editing the paleo-liberal New Republic magazine, a gay man who survived AIDS and remained a faithful Catholic in the long fight for the highly unorthodox idea of gay marriage. He writes regularly now in New York magazine. In conversation this week, he is a marvelously expressive plague veteran.
The first thing that always happens in plagues is that people just don't want to believe it's happening. And if they do, they want to see it happening to other people so that they're separated from it. And I think the ability to find a category in which you're not in danger is essential for people. So people who are young are constantly thinking, well, this isn't going to affect me, it's somebody else's plague, until one of them gets it. And then you realize that nobody is safe. And of course, you continue your existing patterns of behavior because you know no other way to live.
Right.
Until this suddenly interrupts it, you're shocked, you deny it, you then become unnerved, you then come to accept it, I think. And then you have to sort of reorder your life to realize that this new, weird, surreal environment that you're in is your environment. There is no other place to go. Even when, and that continues as long as this thing is in the air, is invisible, can infect you. And even when, and this was fascinating during the AIDS epidemic, even when something intervenes to make it better, for example, a cure or a treatment, or in this case, maybe a vaccine, you'll be amazed how many people will still cling to the patterns of life that they have newly adopted and not want to go back to normal. It's a very weird psychological process.
Yeah, you've been there, Andrew, 35 years practically. It's incredible. But I just wonder what you're, in this moment, when everybody's facing the same, exactly the same thing, what does your memory draw on from the AIDS years?
Well, there are a couple of obvious similarities, which is that you begin to realize that what you're experiencing is just a concentrated form of human life anyway. You know, that we're all going to die at some point. The randomness of that can occur frequently. And that, of course, because the odds in regular life are much, much smaller than they are in plague life, you can put them out of your head. But the truth is, it's just reality intensified. It's mortality intensified in a way. The people who are going to die are random. It's a helpful reminder, if you look at it that way, of reality. That what seems so unreal actually is just a concentrated form of reality. The other thing we can't handle, I think, is that we cannot control it. You have to let it be. I mean, you can do everything you can to avoid it. But if you're alive and if you are around any other human beings, the odds are there, the chances are there. So you live constantly thinking, is this risk enough? Is this risk too much? Is this risk the right amount? I mean, are we really going to seclude ourselves in boxes for the next 12 months? Can we do that? I don't think we can. I don't think human beings can live like that. And what's interesting to me is how people, after the first wave of panic in reality, adjust their lives to make it kind of work.
For sure, it concentrates the mind, as they used to say about the prospect of hanging. But then what? You didn't think that way in the mid-80s when you knew you were in a race for your own survival against what? But take us back to some of those major benchmarks of the AIDS world, the denial and then the endless experiment, the isolation, the humiliation, but eventually, strange to tell, gay marriage and any number of cultural advances, we would have to say.
What was strange about that experience is that there was enormous terror to begin with because no one knew what this was and where it was coming and who it would strike. And for a while, remember, there was not even a test for it, rather like now.
Right.
No one knew who had it and who didn't have it. So what you have is then this horrible doubt in your head. Do I have it? How can you get it? Am I, if I'm doing this, am I going to get it? How do I protect my loved ones? So for a while, when there was no knowledge, then when you got the test and you could, and we knew what it was, then you found out. And then in those days, it was just a horrible waiting period until it got you. So then you were walking around, in our case, for years, just worried that did I, you know, is it going to happen to me? Am I going to make, did I make a mistake? And in some ways, I remember a friend of mine saying to me, and he just wished he had it after a while, because the tension of having it stalking you invisibly all the time was almost unbearable after a while. And you just wanted to get it over with, in a way, to end the uncertainty. Now, of course, there's a big difference, because the fatality rate for AIDS until 1996 was 100%, not 1%. Right. So it's like literally everyone died of it. There are many differences, of course. And the other thing that happened was that in those days, it was restricted. The real pandemic was restricted to a certain population. So we would live in a world that was going around as if there was nothing going on at all. You know, there was no plague. It was just everybody was carrying on as if they had always carried on, whereas we were living in a sort of medieval bubble where people were dropping dead all the time and we had no way of stopping it. Whereas now everybody's in it. Then there's all sorts of things. There are always going to be people who are going to profit off it. There are people selling snake oil. You know, there are people hoarding important materials. There are then quack cures that come up, and people were trying all sorts of remedies for it. But there is also, at some point in this process, you start believing you control it and can control it. And there are some things you can control. But ultimately, what makes an epidemic like this different than an illness or like heart disease or even the flu is that it's exponential and it will kill you. And you can't tell at this point. That's why the testing is so frustrating. For example, if you knew you'd already gotten it and you were now immune, can you imagine the sense of liberation you would have? And those people could then go into the front lines. On the other hand, those of us walking around feeling okay so far are terrified that tomorrow the cough will become the splutter. And that's exactly what happened in AIDS. You know, oh my God, I feel sick. Is that this? Or is it just another thing? Or is it something I don't have to worry about? What frightens me now, to be honest, and I am pretty frightened. I have really bad lungs. I've always had very chronic asthma and vulnerability to bronchitis. So I am extremely nervous about this. Hmm. What made me nervous in particular is I am doing everything I should do. I'm washing hands. I haven't touched a human being now in 13 days. So I secluded myself early. Even food deliveries are left at the door. But then when I look back at when I was in my 20s and going about my life and having sex as I did in those years, using usual safe sex things, methods that you're told, and still got it. And it would be nice for me, honestly, to say I made that mistake and that's how it happened, but I don't remember such a moment. But obviously there was one, and it was almost certainly sexual, but I just don't quite know when and where it happened, which is how I feel now, which is that I can wear a mask outside, I can wash my hands constantly, I can seclude myself from the world, but am I really not going to get this by the end of all this? Like, after a year and a half, if I have to live my life, and we have to live our life, how are we going to live as humans without each other's company? We can't. Solitary confinement is a form of torture, and essentially, we all have to be in solitary confinement for a while. That's the other thing. With AIDS, after a while, you knew that you couldn't get it from just casual contact. And so you were capable of being there with your friends who were sick. You were capable of taking care of, you had the ability to hug one another and to hold one another and to comfort and reassure one another in some security. But no one can do that now. You can't even hug someone because it could be contagious.
And we have... one little mercy, we have Google Hangouts now. We have Skype. We can see and talk and with your doctor, with your best friend, anybody.
We didn't have that in the past, and no one had that in the past. And they were also, most plagues in the past were beset with lack of information. We just didn't know what was going on. But we're like that right now because we don't know in the way that they never knew in the past. I was reading Samuel Pepys's diary in 1665 in London when the plague broke out. And what they did keep tab on was deaths, because those are pretty solid numbers to get anywhere. They went up and down. And sometimes they were just terrified because they keep going up. And then there were these lulls when you saw the numbers come down and you sort of almost thought that was okay. But the difficult thing for a modern person to understand, I think, is that no one is safe. No one. You can't buy yourself out of this. You can't hide yourself out of this beyond certain limits. If it lasts a year or so, which I think it probably will, we have to figure out a whole new way of life, a whole new way of living. We do have all these technological advantages, and it's kind of fascinating because until like a week ago, almost all my contacts with all my friends were by text. And now they're all by phone. We're calling each other again. We want to hear each other's voices. We want to check in on people, whether they're doing okay.
When did it break for you as a public cause of fighting AIDS, but also in your own body, your own health, your own mind?
Suddenly there was treatment that was seemed to be working, and it was it was massive. We were massively overdosed to begin with, but it definitely gave us this, gave me a knowledge that I had no viral load in my system. And psychologically, what's interesting is that at that point was the first time I went into a clinical depression. You're in the middle of this nightmare, and people around you are dying, and every cough you get makes you think it's pneumonia. And then suddenly you're released from all that, and it's over. And not only that, but people you saw dying are then having this strange, at the end of AIDS, was this Lazarus effect, when suddenly they were fine. People you thought were going to be dead.
Right.
And that's when I got depressed. It was as if there's something about plagues or something about what happened then is that you become enacted into a community fighting this thing and helping your fellow brothers and sisters who are with it. And there was something about the atmosphere, the way that some people miss wartime, that gave everybody this direction, purpose, zeal almost, and something to do every day, somebody to worry about, and suddenly all that went away. And I was left, and a lot of us were left, with extreme depression and a sense of bewilderment. And a lot of my generation of survivors went on to be consumed in the crystal meth epidemic about 10 years later. It's complicated. The human psyche is very strange. We all know that. But in these periods, it's fascinating to watch it develop and evolve and respond in ways you don't quite expect. So, for example, I don't think we know in any way what the political or social consequences of this plague is going to be. I mean, we just don't.
Two things I wanted to ask in sort of retrospective from today. One, activism and some remarkable people in every community and communities themselves that did extraordinary things, but also that cultural transformation through people like Tony Kushner, Edmund White, for example, but others, and eventually gay marriage, and a completely changed outlook about what sexuality is, who, what matters, what doesn't, etc. What are the lessons for today?
Well, in that sense, I'm not sure whether the lessons quite apply, because there was a very specific aspect to that epidemic, which is it was so concentrated among gay men and entered a culture which was at that point still profoundly homophobic, and in which widespread response to something was not there. I mean, at the beginning, it was quite narrow. I think there comes a point at which human beings should understand, after some understanding, because look, no one's perfect and governments make mistakes and viruses happen, and you can look back at the beginning of AIDS and see all sorts of people making terrible decisions.
Which ones?
In government. Beginning in government, people were joking about it. They weren't actively rushing to find out what this was, how to cure, because it was just affecting this marginalized group. So there was an enormous amount of complacency there to begin with. Then there was also resistance among gay men for changing their lives completely. And you can see that in the beginning anyway, that there was resistance to believing this was true and to curtailing very hard-won sexual freedom in order to protect ourselves. If you read And the Band Played On,
right,
you'll see that by far the biggest response to begin with was, this isn't happening to us. And if it is, we're not going to change what we do anyway, because that would be giving into it.
Right. These are the kids that are drinking themselves silly in New York, yes, or South Boston or Chicago, even now.
Yes. Yeah, this weekend, I live in Anna's Morgan in Washington, D.C., and it's a bar and club. And it was packed with a bunch of drunk St. Paddy's Day millennials, simply because it doesn't seem real. You know, it doesn't seem real.
Can I ask you a question I couldn't ask almost anybody else? You're well known as a Catholic, a practicing Catholic. I want to know what this does to your Christian cosmology, to your prayer life, to your inner life, to your faith, to your hope. I immediately think of St. Paul to the Romans saying, we glory in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, patience worketh experience, experience hope.
It also reminds me about a story that Joseph Goldstein, the Buddhist, tells, which is that a yogi asks the Buddha, this is apocryphal, but he says, okay, if Buddhism is so simple, explain it in one sentence or one phrase or one word. Mm. And the Buddha says, well, I can't, but I can do it in three. And so the yogi says, well, what? Okay, three, give us three. The three that he lists are, one, everything changes. Two, anything can happen at any time. And three, I am not exempt. Hmm. To understand that you can go too, that you may not be here in a couple of months' time, that this is all temporary. There is nothing certain or fixed or solid. And that is the reality we live with. And everything else is denial. Now, most people cannot live with that much reality. And so we find a way to avoid it. But in some ways, plagues are a form of reality that evokes and has to evoke a spiritual response. Because at some point, you've got to live in the knowledge that you could die, right, which is really living. And we're so capable of putting that out of our heads.
Andrew Sullivan, it's a privilege and wonderful to hear you. You've been there, and I'm so glad you're still with us to sort of guide us through.
Thank you so much, Christopher.
Thanks also to David Jones, John Ioannidis, and Silvia Poggioli in Rome. Our show was produced in lockdown quarantine from my dinner table by the heroic team of Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Paul Kahlo was our engineer. Mary McGrath is the chief in our virtual clinic. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.